Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We are once again diving into the fascinating and fantastic this evening, talking about the Edward Albert Meyer case, the Billy Meyer case. Billy is an 80-year-old author who lives in Switzerland. He lives in a tiny mountain village nestled in the pine forests and the mountains of northern Switzerland, about 45 minutes east of Zurich. Billy's had a fantastic life. He's done so many interesting things. He's since the age of before 5 years old, he had telepathic contact with an extraterrestrial human named Svoth. Svoth was a 1,000-year-old man who lived in a different space-time configuration than we exist on here on the Earth. The universe that we live in has seven dimensions. These dimensions are realities that have stars and planets and solar systems and galaxies just like ours. There's nothing unusual or very, very strange about these different dimensions. They're almost variations on a theme. For example, Svoth's dimensions has more planets with human civilizations. So people that live on these planets, it's much easier to visit other worlds with life. You might have to travel 12 light years in our dimension to come to another planet with life on it, with intelligent life on it. But it's different in Svoth's dimension. Svoth came here for the first time, I think, in 1943 or 42. And he had telepathic contact with Billy. Billy traveled out into the forest near his home in Blue Lock and came out of the forest when Svoth landed his ship. Now, what was interesting and something that I hadn't quite picked up on before is that first contact was telepathic and not physical, even though Billy got to see a ship, because shortly thereafter the ship took off and left. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that they had their first face-to-face meeting. But Svoth had saved Billy's life. When Billy was only 6 months old, he had a terrible pneumonia that he almost died from. In fact, the doctors were about to tell Billy's parents that he would die during the night, would probably, or in the early morning, would pass away. But Svoth came somehow into their home and used some kind of technical device to heal Billy. So Billy had these telepathic contacts with Svoth, and during these telepathic contacts, he could see Svoth's face. So he knew kind of who he was. So when they had their first face-to-face meeting, it wasn't so shocking or so strange. Now, Billy was very concerned that he was losing his mind at first, even at that young age. Billy had advanced very, very quickly. And he talked to the local pastor at his church, Pastor Rudolph Zimmerman, about this. And Pastor Zimmerman told him the telepathic contacts were very important and they had a very special mission and that he didn't need to worry, that he was fine. And in fact, Pastor Rudolph Zimmerman himself had had telepathic contact from this extraterrestrial group. So eventually, Billy went to the forest again. It was a couple years later, and out of the sky came the same silvery, strange pear-shaped craft, and this time, Svoth stepped out of the ship, and Billy could see his silvery suit, a kind of a coverall, and he had a helmet, I guess, that was missing, and Svoth wasn't wearing. And Billy was picked up by electronic means, some kind of almost like invisible hands picked Billy up and pulled him into the ship. And eventually, Svoth and Billy left, and I think they went like 70 kilometers high, which is really high. And Billy looked around the craft, and he could see these, what he thought were first were small windows, but they were actually viewing screens like we would eventually develop on the Earth. And Svoth told Billy many things, told him about his previous lives where he had lived as prophets that have a slightly different names now than they did then, and that he had been Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. And then in each one of these lives, he taught an ancient universal teaching called the Teaching of the Spirit, which he was going to teach again in this lifetime. And one of the things that Svoth did was attach all these different electrodes to Billy's brain and his head, and there were all these buttons and switches, and young Edward Albert Meyer sat there with no fear. And when Billy felt this device come on, he was filled with what he called like strange powers that opened up his mind to things that I guess he had learned in previous lifetimes, and gave him abilities that he had had in previous lifetimes. So that was a brief overview of the the early contacts that Billy had with Svoth. Svoth told Billy about things that would happen in the future on the Earth, like the atomic bombs that would be dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He described, also Svoth described, a time of confusion and maliciousness that would spread over the Earth. And he told Billy that people would try to kill him, that his own wife would leave him, and that he would experience suffering, but that he would also have a very good life in many ways, but he would have much difficulty. And in fact, Billy missed something like 111 days of school during 1 year alone. And during most of that time, he was meeting with Svoth. And Billy learned a great deal during that time of his life. That was the Billy met with Svoth for about 11 years, where he received much wisdom and much schooling. Unfortunately, his father would often beat Billy because he was skipping school until he could neither sit nor stand. Billy was really toughened up a lot by his early experiences. And it was in about 1953 that he had his second teacher send a robotic ship to Switzerland. Billy went up on a hill that he often went to contemplate things. And he would sometimes meditate on this hill. And then out of the sky came a strange craft with a very unusual tripod, circular kind of landing device on it. And again, Billy was again lifted up by almost what he called ghostly hands and brought into the ship, which was completely robotic. And Billy sat down at the seat, and there was a bright flash of light, and Billy became invisible, and the ship became invisible, and the craft started to float off the hill and went over slowly to the village where Billy lived, and was just a few meters above the roof on a house where he lived. And then it took off at a very, very high rate of speed and went high into the air. And Billy, he got to see the Indian Ocean, which was beautiful and quite a sight. Yeah, Billy was 16 years old at this time, and he also got to look up at a beautiful night sky in space, where he saw the stars twinkle with such a brightness that he'd never seen before. And he also saw what he described as a stunning disk in the sky, which was the sun, seen from the edge of space. He was in the ship nearly in the edge of space, and then the craft descended very quickly, and below him Billy could see the pointed structures of the pyramids, which we were talking about the pyramids last night. And this craft landed at some distance from the Great Pyramid, actually in the country of Jordan. And Billy stepped out of the craft, and he felt the heat of Jordan, and he felt the sand, the reddish sand and the reddish rocks. And out of the sky, something like a falling star came with great speed and then came down and like stopped suddenly and came down very slowly after that and got larger. And after it got to the point where it was ready to land, it was immense. It was a 300-meter disc. And out stepped this woman who looked like, the way Billy described it, was a modern angel. And he was stunned at just the attractiveness of her. And the other thing that impressed him was that he felt that he knew her, and he couldn't understand why or how he knew her. And she told him that she should search himself for the memories that she could not tell him, but that she would have to, that he would have to search himself for the memories of his knowledge of her. And of course, I tell the story a lot. They both went in the ship and flew to the Giza Plateau and landed the craft nearby the Sphinx. Now, the craft was completely invisible, and Billy and Askett went outside the ship, and they were invisible as well. They both had devices on that made themselves invisible. They could see each other, but no one else could see them. Billy went into tents where there were some native women, I think called Bedouin, and Billy played some tricks on some local women there and kissed them, and they practically fainted, and it was a strange story there in the contact report. It's Billy's first contacts with Askett. And they went down this dark corridor that led underground, underneath the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid of Giza is 73,000 years old. It was built with the help of extraterrestrial humans from Orion. The pyramids around the Earth were built 73,000 years ago and 35,000 years ago. Billy and Askett traveled long ways underground in this dark passage, and they finally came to this very large stone, an ashlar, they call it in the contact reports. And it dissolved in front of them, and they both stepped through, and then it reformed behind them. It was like some doorway, you could say. And Billy saw ancient spacecraft in there, a very large one, smaller beam ships. He saw strange guards that were dressed very strangely. And there was a platform over to the right where there was a cross. There was a crown of thorns. There was blood-encrusted nails and a leather pouch that contained some kind of valuable stones or silver coins or something to that effect. And Billy, who had grown up in a religious Protestant background, knew about the cross and this was very strange to him and very troubling in an effect. And him and Asket left together, and they went back to the surface. And once they got to the surface, Asket talked to him, and I think they talked together for a long, long time about this, about the religions of the earth, and about Atlantis and Lemuria, and about the Giza intelligences. And some of the facts about the Giza intelligence, they were still here even during the time of World War II. They influenced Hitler through the Thule Society, through one man in particular called Erik Jonasson, whose real name was Hermann Steinschneider, who taught Hitler things like the power of suggestion, and he also kind of steered Hitler down the wrong path. Hitler would have been a great leader. In fact, he was destined to be a great leader. The Pleiaron themselves had impulsed him to be a great leader. And I think the world, if Hitler wasn't negatively influenced by the Giza intelligences, the world would have been in a much better situation than it is today. We live in what's called the third millennium here on the earth. It's a time of confusion, a time of maliciousness, a time that Sloth told Billy about. Our biggest problem, according to Sloth, was that we didn't understand this thing called the creation, and that everything in the whole universe is one, and it's all bound together. And this universal intelligence is on a path of evolution, and that the physical universe that we live in is a spherical shape thing that has seven counter-rotating layers, and only one of these layers is matter, is physical. The rest of it you could think of as fine matter or spiritual or energetic. But in that fourth layer of our universe is all the galaxies, all the stars, all the planets. And this physical layer is divided into seven different time planes, or seven different space-time configurations, seven different dimensions. So our lineage, our family, so to speak, is not even from this dimension. The Lyrians, who have two branches that come below them, the Pleiaron and the Timmers, are not from even this dimension. And they came to the earth in the ancient past, particularly the Lyrians, and, well, the Pleiaron as well, and they kind of interfered with the natural evolution of the people of earth. And one of the things that happened is the introduction of religion, which took us down a cul-de-sac. It put us in a dead end. We took a turn down the wrong street and came to a dead end. And we had traveled quite some way on this dead end street until we realized we're in a cul-de-sac. And we have to turn around and go back where we came before we can get back on the right path. You see, we're a society that's ill in its consciousness, and we're all there. We have to find the way back to thinking clearly again. And the way back to thinking clearly and the way back to the key to our future survival is what I call disclosure two. Disclosure one, people like Stephen Bassett are still struggling for. I think the first disclosure has already happened. People like Sergeant Clifford Stone, who claims that he was in a crash retrieval team in the military that would sometimes go to these places where craft were either shot down or crashed and interface. Stone would interface with these with these beings, with these intelligences. Sergeant Robert Dean has talked about when he was at Supreme Headquarters Allied Command, it's called SHAPE Headquarters, he was given a classified book to read that described the extraterrestrial groups that had been visiting the Earth, and there were supposedly six of them. He also saw pictures of crashes and things like that. Dr. Hermann Oberth was the mentor of Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientist, the Nazi rocket scientist. Dr. Hermann Oberth said that the people of Germany could not take credit for their advances alone because they had been helped by people of other worlds. Dr. Hermann Oberth said this in the 70s in a public meeting. If that isn't disclosure, I don't know what is. Colonel Wendell Stevens from the U.S. Air Force wrote several books on the Meyer case. Other cases he wrote about, Stephen DiNardo, Colonel Donald Ware, who I've had on the show many times before he had his stroke, talks about all the contacts that have gone on. And so the disclosure, in my opinion, the first stage of disclosure has already happened. What is happening now is the most important part, where the people of the Earth begin to learn the important things, which is the wisdom that these other groups of people have attained. For example, the Pleiaren have not had war for 20,000 years, if you can imagine. I don't think we've had 70 years of peace on the Earth in the last five centuries. That's just off the top of my head. But so this is why we're still focused on learning the might of our own thoughts, because this is the key to what is called, in page 225, the source of life power, which must be created by oneself, lies in the consciousness. That is to say, in the thoughts, which must be formed, tended, and nurtured in such a way that they correspond to a progressive, kind, and wise, equipped with a zeal for life, an intention, an endeavor, an ideal, a good, positive life zeal, which is volitionally and imaginatively striven for to the point of realization by means of one's striving for that which is higher and for that which is evolutive, and by means of the might which is developed in the thoughts. And this is about a 20 to 30 page section. And for some reason, something came to me which may be helpful to you. It's been very helpful to me. Four major things talked about in this area in the book. And you can ask yourself, or make these statements better yet, say, I am optimistic, I am cheerful, I am confident, I am relaxed. Let's try it again. I am confident, I am optimistic, I am cheerful, I am relaxed. And just saying this out loud, just saying I am confident, I am optimistic, will start to turn around your thoughts. Do not ever allow yourselves to drift on the ocean of life. Rather, take the helm in hand and steer that ship of the life to solid ground. Always hold the helm firm in your hands and do not let any waves rip it away from you. On the ship of life, every single human being is his or her own captain, who must not sleep, but rather must always be awake and control and steer everything. Optimism is a prerequisite for the constancy in life. So optimism is so important. When you feel your optimism going away, you know that your thoughts have started to run out of control. And the challenge there is we face some pretty difficult life circumstances where it's real easy to let your optimism go away and your confidence go away. The majority of humanity simply lets itself go and lives in a state of uncontrolled vexation. Uncountable human beings are driven by uncontrolled and ungoverned sorrow, as well as by untamed passions, desires, and bad habits. There's another line in here somewhere that I've committed to memory. It says, every human should overcome, humans who do not overcome their weaknesses and who do not free themselves from their negative and uncontrolled thoughts will remain weak, wretched, and miserable. That's a very poignant piece of information. Human beings who do not overcome their weaknesses and free themselves from their negative and unproductive thoughts will remain weak, wretched, and miserable. So, as it says here, the majority of humanity simply lets itself go and lives in an uncontrolled state of vexation. So what happens when you do that is you'll have anxiety, fear, and doubt. They'll surge, and then they'll abate with malicious turbulence. This majority of human beings stand in contrast to only a few really wise ones, a handful of knowledgeable ones, who, as the absolute minority, take on the responsibility for the continued certainty of the progress in the existence of the Earth human beings. Since time immemorial, the destiny of humanity has laid in their hands and in the might of their thoughts, as it also does for all of the future. But unfortunately, there are only a few of them, which is why there exists the absolute requirement that the human beings of the great mass wake up and begin to think and act with the minority of the knowledgeable and wise ones, so that a conscious evolution can take hold collectively. But to that end, it is necessary that the individual and the entire mass of humanity begins to think clearly and consciously and creates, by means of the might of the thoughts, all that which leads to peace, to freedom, gladness, love, knowledge, and wisdom, from which finally, as special values, equanimity, and inner all-penetrating cheerfulness emerge. So there's cheerfulness. Is one of the things I was saying is critical. So I am confident. I'm optimistic. I'm cheerful. And I'm relaxed. The human being must basically learn to lead, guide, and govern himself / herself. And he / she must learn to adapt himself, herself, to all things, situations, surrounding, and circumstances. And once this is learned, then the human being is able to be pleased with himself or herself, in all modesty and righteousness, without thinking of him or herself as something special. The more calm, peaceful, joyous, loving, free, and harmoniously equalized the human being becomes, the more comprehensive his or her potential for thought becomes. So the calmer you are, the more potential for thought you have. And speaking of thought, there is a universal intelligence. It's called the creation in the Meyer material. It's not anything like a Heavenly Father. It is a neutral, positive entity. It is more, the Germans have a word called the Wesenheiten. And a Wesenheiten, for example, would be water. You could think of the Pacific Ocean or certain rocks. And these are things which have spirit energy in them. So everything that's living has spirit energy. For example, the ocean has spirit energy, but it has no personality. A tree has spirit energy in it, but it has no personality. So when you're looking at the ocean or when you're looking at a tree, you're probably getting a better idea of what creation is like, the universal consciousness. It really doesn't have a personality, just like a tree doesn't have a personality, neither does the Pacific Ocean. Now, here's the other thing which is difficult for us to understand and wrap our minds around. The universal consciousness radiates love, and yet it has no personality. Now, this is something that we, in our human thinking, have sometimes a hard thing to imagine. But this is the true case. It radiates love. The creation, the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. And creation radiates love. And when you begin to feel the radiating love of creation, there is something going on inside of your spiritual consciousness called empfinding. And that's a fine, sensitive, spiritual feeling that you'll start to get once you get to where you can sense the radiating love of creation. The incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. And creation radiates love. Love is the highest principle in all creation. And through it, everything exists in absolute logic. So all the trees and the animals and the plants, you're looking at logic there. There's a tremendous logic to what creation has done and put all these different things together. And every tiny plant, every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in love. Now, outside of the predator-prey relationship, which I guess you could look at as one of the imperfections of creation. Creation is imperfect. It's evolving. It's tremendous the way it is. It's a fantastic intelligence beyond our wildest imaginations even. But it is still evolving. And it evolves with a specific series of steps which go at specific times. And that's why it's called a Wesenheiten, because it takes these steps, these evolutionary steps, always at these predetermined intervals. It doesn't have the free will like a human being does. A human being is considered a Wesen. We have a personality. We reincarnate in physical bodies for 40 to 60 million years. So you may need only 40 million years. I may want to hang around for another 20 million years because I like the physical body. But in any case, we're both, after that 40 to 60 million years, going to go to the next step, which is a half physical, half spiritual state, where we spend something like another 30 million years, and then to a point where we're completely spiritual. And we start to evolve through these seven different planes. And the planes begin with an area called Arahat Athrasada. And one of the things that Svoth taught Billy was the ability to pull information down from this spiritual plane called Arahat Athrasada. And Billy learned to do that telepathically at a fairly young age. Now, Erhat Athrasad, again, is a spiritual plane, and it's the first level where pure spirit forms dwell. And this is the beginning of stage that we'll get to when we start our process of merging back with creation. Now, Billy has written a book called Erhat Athrasada. And Erhat Athrasada in Sanskrit means the precious one who contemplates the times. And I'll read to you something about the Erhat Athrasada book. It says, the terrestrial human race is entering and witnessing a phase of very powerful cosmic change. It is a new era, a new age, which continually and distinctively becomes clear to the eyes of the observant, consciously more advanced human beings. While most of mankind here on Earth lies in a deep abyss of ignorance and of consciousness enslavement. Now, let me throw in something here. To me, one of the biggest things I've learned since studying the Might of Thoughts is how much consciousness enslavement we have. We're enslaved to unproductive thoughts. We're enslaved to negative thinking, to the point of driving ourselves insane. And I've seen slowly myself becoming free from this thinking, which has polluted my mind my whole life. It's a very step-by-step process. Let me continue here. Most of mankind here on Earth lies in a deep abyss of ignorance and of consciousness enslavement. It has become an urgent necessity through investigations to find the causes of mankind's decline and to demonstrate this to human beings in a correct, clear, and revealing message and lesson. Simultaneously, it necessitates showing new ways which would guide mankind toward a future of conscious comprehension and harmony. It is now time, therefore, for the earthling to open his eyes and ears and detach his enslaved thoughts from false teachings, to free himself from traditional falsehoods and all evil, and finally comprehend everything according to the truth. So this is what I call Disclosure Part 2. And this is such an important phase. I mean, this is so much more important than Disclosure Phase 1. This is where we start to gain the wisdom to guide, to lead, guide, and govern ourselves. We must learn to adapt to all situations and surroundings. And through that, we can have freedom in our thinking. And the human being creates calmness, joy, peace, love, freedom, and harmony in himself or herself as he or she starts to understand himself as a Vesan, or all human beings are Vesan. Dogs, cats, higher animals are Vesan. We have a personality. We have a free will. You know, the creation functions so automatically. I wonder if it has a free will the same way we do. I don't know. Let me continue to read a little bit from Erhat Athrasada here, and then I'll kind of get us back on track. In the middle of all earthly events, the human stands with globally the highest developed spirit form. Let's talk a little bit, another tangent, here I go, about our spirit forms. Your spirit form is a tiny fragment of the universal consciousness. It will never die. It records everything that you do, all your thoughts, your impulsations. It will tell you if your thinking is right or wrong, if you've learned to pay attention to it. It resides in an area in the middle brain called the superior colliculus, and an area that's influenced by your sight. Its energy goes throughout the whole body. When, you know, a loved one dies, that energy will leave the body. You'll see the energy leave the eyes. The spirit form can never be harmed by anything in the material realm. It is the wonder of all wonders, Sannyasa called it. The spirit energy stays in the body for even 3 and 4 hours after death. You can harvest organs at this time because the spirit energy is still there. Your spirit form is you have a spiritual lineage. There have been people that have incarnated on the earth. Your previous personalities, your spiritual lineage, you have a background. Most spirit forms, human spirit forms on the earth, are about 4 million years old. Now what happens, there's a dimension outside the physical dimension where the spirit form goes in between lifetimes, and it takes with it your material consciousness. Your material consciousness is your personality. It's your conscious mind and your unconscious mind, your subconscious mind. Now, the unconscious mind is a fascinating thing because the unconscious mind works extremely quickly. Before anything is done by your mind, the unconscious mind is evaluating first what's going to happen. Your unconscious mind, I think, in some ways is the most powerful part of your consciousness. It can pull your hand away from a burning stove quicker than your conscious mind can even think the thought. If you come into contact with something that is unusual and special and important, it will immediately, the unconscious mind makes a decision to connect with the subconscious. And the subconscious will work on the problem. And that's why a lot of times in your sleep, you'll be working out a problem. Your subconscious and your unconscious are working away while you're sleeping, the conscious mind sleeping. And you're dealing with this issue you're trying to figure out. Now, in the death process, the conscious goes out, the subconscious, the unconscious, the conscious mind, the spirit takes all of that into the spiritual realm. And in the spirit realm, the spirit form has already created a place called the overall consciousness block. And the material consciousness from your last lifetime goes into the overall consciousness block. And that overall consciousness block goes through all your previous life memories and the things you learned. And it kind of summarizes them down into their essence. So the essence that you've learned about hope and wisdom and logic and love and a sense of peace and confidence and optimism and all these things are distilled down into their essence. And the spirit form absorbs them. And this increases the power of the spirit form and its overall level of awareness. And the same information is also spread into the storage banks, and it goes into the subconscious, the new subconscious, because the overall conscious block will create the new conscious mind, the new subconscious, the new unconscious, the new personality. And then the spirit form, with all this information from the consciousness, is pulled back into the body of a child again. Now, your level of spiritual evolution as this child in the womb is at the level it left off in the adult portion of its life, in the previous life. But the material consciousness is not there yet. You have to learn to talk again, you have to learn to walk again, you have to learn arithmetic again, you have to learn all the basics again. But this spiritual consciousness that's in the superior colliculus will impulse the material consciousness. And it's much easier to come back up through these evolution, the material consciousness to evolve. Now, Billy, at a very young age, at the age of about 5 or 6 years old, was as evolved as a 35-year-old man because of his interaction with Svath and the things he had learned from Svath. So he had an accelerated consciousness, and he was very sensitive to higher vibration, much more so than the typical Earth human. So he would get a lot more information than we typically would, and that's why, as a young boy, when he crawled out that lower window of his bedroom at night in May, maybe of 41, and sat down on the bench that his father had made and looked up at a beautiful starry sky, he said, "My life is made out of the love of creation." And he said, "Since ancient times, I've lived among the stars." And he felt this longing for the faraway worlds and distant places. And you see, young Billy was getting impulses from these storage banks, which are like signals. And his spirit form is very ancient. So it's impulsing his material consciousness as a young boy. And he wrote it like this. He said, "I heard my voice say, since ancient times, I've lived among the stars." It was almost like it was speaking from the power of spirit form. So he had this deep awareness, and he knew the purpose of his life at this point and what his life calling was. And this comes from the spirit form. And I got off on a gigantic tangent there. Let me continue in this Arhat Atharvasada. It's speaking about humanity. "He has all the things of this world to place into order and to value them according to the all-encompassing unitary law of creational order, recognizing in all earthly laws of nature. As first, he is obliged, responsible to the task of preserving his life for the duration of his developmentally given time. As second, he has to pay heed to the fulfillment of the duty to further develop himself spiritually and consciously in the best possible way, and to acknowledge the spiritual evolution as an important truth. As a community being, he is obliged, responsible for the task of preserving his species, kind, and to instruct and educate his offspring in the meaning, the sense of the spiritual teaching. But further, the task is imposed on him to align and integrate himself into a naturally ordered community, which does likewise guarantee an evolution in every relation, regard, as nature visibly and livingly exemplifies. The preservation of the human species is not based on a formula of simple propagation, augmentation, as such the erroneous teachings of earthly religions proclaim. The preservation of the species is based on the compliance with following the natural laws. As such, the compliance is in holiness, therefore monitoring, supervising, regarding, and controlling." And it goes on to talk about propagation and the incredible problems we have, where we've destroyed nature. And the overpopulation is destroying the forests, which is one of the biggest problems, because the trees of the forests were absorb the warmth, because without the trees, the light just reflects off the snow. But the trees create this buffer zone of warmth in the winter. Now, in the summer, they do just the opposite. They create this shaded area of coolness. If you're in a thick forest, all forests are not this thick. But I happen to live by one. I'm very quite lucky. And if you go into the center of the forest, it can be 90 degrees outside, and it'll be 70 degrees in the center of that thick forest. And it's cooler and it's darker in there. When the wind blows over the top of the forest, it creates a turbulence, like a spiral, like a vortex, which will help form clouds and help bring rain. So the forest is this whole unit of life all together. And there's this beautiful passage in the Goblet of Truth. It's entitled, What the Truth Knows to Say. And it says, rivers, stones, plants, bushes, trees, everything that crawls and flies on the earth is a life form with a spirit form. And these spirit forms are on a journey through time, which involve many, many lifetimes. And death is just the passage to rebirth. Rebirth into the world of pure spirit. And many of these creatures are connected by psychic vibrations. And they are aware of each other. So if you go into the forest, you can hear the cicadas and the crickets and the birds and the frogs and the peepers and all the animals as they communicate with one another. It's because they're all part of creation. And Svas said, everything in the universe is all bound together. It's all one. And because we don't understand the oneness of all things, we don't understand that a tree has consciousness. We don't understand that it has spirit energy. We will just destroy this life as if it has no meaning or no value. It's because we have no empathy. We have no compassion. We have no moral reasoning. And we're kind of turning ourselves into these zombies. And if you listen to the music today, it is like that. We have this heavy driving either beat or heavy driving metallic music, which is reflecting the values of our civilization. It really reflects the hysteria. There's a hysteria and a desperation in that music. And people get off on the power of it. It's because they've lost their sensitivity. We are in a civilization that's indolent and obtuse. They're too lazy to go out and find and learn things anymore, and they're obtuse. They've started to lose the ability to think, and particularly independent thinking. And this is the danger that we have now. There's so much which numbs us. All of the media is now focused on numbing us. And drugs, what do they really do? They numb you. This is where we're at as a society. It's a very dangerous situation. There's a very interesting book called The Way to Live, which is very, very critical if you want to learn. And it talks about one of these creational natural laws called striving. Striving is so important for your happiness, particularly if you're going through difficult times. Striving is extremely important. I'll read a little passage from page 102. It says, striving creates the life right up to the being. Striving means delectation in a form which is always fulfilling and progressive. To be without striving means unwillingness and affliction. Affliction is inhibited striving and inhibited life, but inhibited striving and inhibited life bring inhibited evolution and stagnation. But inhibited striving and inhibited life bring inhibited evolution, stagnation, hopelessness, and grief, confusion, irrationality, joylessness, cognitionless, unpeace, disharmony, lovelessness, resentment. Lack of striving beings, lives, self-deceit, reluctance for life. Therefore, delectation, harmony, and happiness, as well as everything positive, as well as grief and everything negative, are in the end only the revelation of how pronounced striving is in any life form. Depending on the degree and the strength of the striving, of any single reason, it will assert itself in the world and prevail, or will fall, shatter, waste away, and come to an end and vanish. And striving does not end with the death, as the human being may assume, because striving is also included in the death. The human being strives for life and the death at the same time, because the Grim Reaper accompanies the human being to new life and to new striving. The death is an interlude between two lives and the level of the realm of the other world, in which striving finds its progress and keeps the life alive. So your spirit form strives in the spirit realm, and it absorbs all the information from your previous life. And that's the way of nature, until your spirit form again is then placed into the body of a child at 21 days after the sperm fertilizes the egg. And then the process for striving can continue overtly in the next material life. You've been listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Have a great evening. Thanks for listening.